Stop 2, Pennywaite Flat Cemetery. From the car park at the rear of the market building, turn left into Forest Street, the Pyrenees Highway, and proceed through the roundabout towards Melbourne. After 1.6 kilometres at the top of the hill, turn left into Murphy Street. There's a sign to Pennywaite Flat Cemetery near the phone box on the left. After 400 metres, turn into Collars Road, cross the bridge, and continue 500 metres. There's parking on the left. Pause this now till you get to the car park and restart when you're at the cemetery gate. Welcome to Pennywaite Flat Cemetery. Locals often call it the Children's Cemetery, as it's believed there were up to 200 children buried here during the Gold Rush. As you go inside the cemetery gate, the first grave is closer than you think, just a few metres beyond the gate, under the second big tree. The grave is a rough rectangle of stones, without a headstone, and is a typical Pennywaite flat grave. It may have had a wooden cross, but since the 1850s, such crosses have naturally turned to dust. Other graves here are entirely unmarked, so tread gently. You'll find one, a stone circle here, so small that it would hardly contain a baby. This hill was just a hill without much gold, hardly a pennyweight's worth, so the diggers buried their loved ones here, satisfied that the graves would be left alone. This was never consecrated ground, and it lasted from 1851 to 1854, the fast and furious years of the Gold Rush. It was sudden, intense, and fiery. Then the Gold Rush passed into history, and the diggers moved on to the next rush, or settled to build towns like Castlemaine. This graveyard then took on an air of abandonment that you can feel here today. So take a wander. This song, Pennywaite Hill, is sung by Kate Burke. When the song ends, pause the pod tour and go to a high point where you can see the river flats. Then restart, and author Robert Anear will bring alive the crazy Gold Rush scene that rocked and rolled in the valley below. Thank you.
thrown to the weather, cradles of treasure, tethered forever to four seasons' mill. Gold for the taking is lead for the making of every day breaking. On Pennyweight Hill. The rush on the land, the mud from the pan, the fall of a man into greed, brought death to the water. Forgive me, my daughter. How can I ever return from my knees? And how easily your tar and his dreams were lost to the fever of gold. Working the earth for all the time worth, finding there's nothing but misery.
That was Kate Burke singing Pennyweight Hill by Michael Kennedy. And by now you should be heading for a high spot with a view of the flats below. However, if you want to take more time, pause this till you get there. And now, assuming you're at a place with a view, the flats below are a lazy scene. But in the gold rush, this place was something like an Hieronymus Bosch painting of a folk festival in a graveyard with sly grog. Recently I sat here with the author of Nothing But Gold, Robin Anear, and I let her paint the picture.
If we were here during the gold rush, say if we were here in September 1852, we'd have seen, well, people compared it, strangely enough, to a graveyard with lots of holes, a graveyard all standing empty with lots of holes with heaps of dirt and gravel beside them. And only small holes because people had only a small claim, 3 or 4 metres square. So they could dig themselves a nice sized grave within that, or a hole with some gold at the bottom, they hoped. But to people with new eyes to the gold fields who'd just come around the corner from Golden Point on their way from Melbourne, at the end of that long road from Melbourne, when they came around here and clapped eyes on Pennyweight Flat, that was one of the first thoughts that came to lots of people, was it looks like a graveyard with all the graves stood open, as if on Judgment Day. There was a lot of noise that went with it, though, the noise of cradles, the cradles that washed the gravel that was dug out of those holes and had water ladled through it with an old tin, and the noise of that gravel being washed back and forth on the tin plate with the holes pierced through it was not deafening, but again, until you came in sight of them and saw what that noise was, you could not imagine. This was in an age before big machinery, but the sound of hundreds of cradles working at once was, as we would hear, some massive earth-moving machine or something today. But to 19th century ears, it was unimaginable what that noise could be. So the noise met people before the sight. But then they would come around and perhaps up on a hill and see Pennyweight Flat, and then September 1852, it was all pretty new and raw because gold in good quantities had been discovered here. So it had been rushed just that month or the month before in August 1852. And people arriving in Melbourne had heard about it and rushed up here to get their claim on Pennyweight Flat. Because the reason there were lots of people arriving here and arriving in Melbourne that month, September 1852, in the springtime when the rain was just starting to come down and give them water to wash their gravel with, was that a lot of those people arriving at that time of year had heard about the gold rushes here at Mount Alexander back in the northern spring of 1852, in about April, when these six ships carrying 8 tons of gold had come up the Thames in London, and the news of that had spread throughout the kingdom, had spread throughout the British Isles, telling people about the gold that was awaiting anybody who cared to dig it up at Mount Alexander. And when those people arrived here, roughly 6 months later, so they'd thought about it, they'd hatched the idea of coming here, they'd convinced their family, said their goodbyes, packed all their stuff, booked their passage on the boat, etc., etc., and made that hazardous journey across the seas and lobbed here at Mount Alexander in 6 months later in September. And this, really, Pennyweight Flat, is what awaited those new chums. And it was a brand new rush that was spreading all its way up this long valley of Pennyweight Flat and Moonlight Flat as it grows into further up. So at the Pennyweight Flat Cemetery, they'd have seen this other graveyard-looking landscape, but it was full of excited people. There weren't many lying prostrate on the ground there, except those who were exhausted from rocking their cradles too much. Full of excited ant-like figures, working hard, shoveling their stuff, carrying their buckets, rocking their cradles and climbing in and out of the holes, and possibly the odd one, you know, jumping up with a fistful of something and saying, "Eureka."
On the far view over there at the bottom of the hill, it looks like there's a creek running along there. Would that have been their supply of water?
There is a trickle of a creek in the distance there. It was probably more of a trickle in those days, things being considerably drier now than they've been for a long time. And Forest Creek itself was down close to the main road here at the far end of Pennyweight Flat. So there was water in both those places. And yes, it would have been somebody's job in each party of men that was digging here, or even the kids, or even the missus, to be fetching that water.
And what about the kids? This is known as a children's cemetery. It occurs to me that the diggings might have been heaven and hell for a kid.
I get the impression that kids on the diggings, so long as they lived through it, had a pretty terrific life, especially at first when before the schools got here. Their lives were just all game playing. They were freed from school, and they just were helpers. I mean, they were valued pairs of hands, each child, and pairs of feet to run for things and run for water and carry wash dirt and do all the things they could to help their dads around the diggings. And that was boys and girls alike were valued for that. They had their sharp eyes were greatly valued too, especially after rain. They were closer to the ground than the adults, so they could more easily spot any gold that was lying around on the surface. And that was a job they did for themselves as much as for their parents. And they'd find bits of gold. They'd go specking after gold, after rain. They'd look on everybody's, climb over everybody's heap of discarded dirt from their holes, and any gold they found, if they were lucky, was theirs. And then they would do what any kid would do, go to the shops and exchange the gold for lollies. So that was great fun. They had to, obviously, they'd run around at night the way any kids would on the diggings. You know what it's like when you go camping, you run around at campground at night like wild things, and that was great fun. But of course, there were hazards here. Being a gold field, it was full of deep holes, many of them with water at the bottom, and many a child, well, numbers of children, met their deaths that way, by falling into holes full of water and drowning, nobody hearing their cries. The other things kids did was taking horses some distance to find grass for them to eat. There was a drought on much of the time in the early first year of the diggings, and horses, as the ground was turned over for gold and there was no feed, no grass to be found, horses had to be taken further and farther and farther afield to find feed. And at the end of a day, so horses might be dragging washed dirt to and from the creek during the day or doing other work of that sort. And then of an evening, as the sun started going down, the kids would often be given the job, while Dad was still working at the claim, would be given the job of taking the horses, and other men's horses too. The kids would make quite a bit of pocket money taking these horses up the valleys and out into the bush, or out to find a bit of grass where there was something for the horse to munch on until morning, and they'd have to fix the hobbles to the horses so they wouldn't wander too far away, and put the bells to their necks so that they could be heard when they went looking for them the next morning. And it was a really important job, because you lost your horse. A horse was worth a lot of money, and its labour was incalculable in worth. So the kids were given a very responsible job, and they loved it, you know, because they'd ride the horses out there and tool around a bit while they were there, do some musharooming if it was that time of year, if it was autumn. So there was a real sense of freedom to taking the horses out and getting the horses in the morning, and quite a bit of pocket money as well. The kids' life here, if they survived it, I think was a hell of a life.
The picture I get is of movement from what you're saying.
Yeah, if you were sitting up here in the Pennyweight Flat Cemetery, during the height of the rush here on Pennyweight Flat, there'd be this sense of constant movement, of people crawling across the landscape, but busily. There'd be great busyness in the noise and in what you saw. Because consider, every 4 metres square that you could see would be occupied by a claim, and each claim would be worked by somewhere between 4 to 6 men. So that's a lot of people crammed into this landscape. I like to imagine it at night too, when right along this long valley, along the margins of the valley, would have been the tents of the diggers. And every tent had its campfire chopping down. There wouldn't have been near as many trees as you can see now, but there would have been a hell of a lot of campfires. So people likened it to a string of beads, a string of burning red beads looking down along a valley at night. Some of the campfires would have been bigger than others, because there was a bit of contest went on there as to who could have, I guess, the most hospitable campfire. Because the bigger the campfire, the more people would be drawn to it, and you would become the kind of neighbourhood centre. You'd have perhaps more logs for lounging set up around your campfire, and bigger ones and more comfortable ones than anybody else. And so more people would gravitate towards your tent, and it would, you know, everybody wanted to, well, everybody except the solitary ones who just wanted to read their books before the mice ate them, would like to the accolade of having the biggest logs, the biggest fire, the most diggers gathered around their tent at night.
Nothing changes.
No, well, it was, instead of, you know, a big screen TV, it was a big campfire, and there was a real contest about that. So I love this image, and you can really picture it as you look off in the distance down along Pennyweight Flat and along that valley. You can picture that string of burning red beads represented by the campfires. There were, of course, no street lights, no cars, no anything else except the odd flicker of someone's pipe or cigarette. That was it. And you certainly didn't venture too far from those campfires because of what might await you in the dark, in the way of a deep hole with a hard landing at the bottom.
That was author Robert Anea. Now it's on to Stop 3, the Forest Creek digging site. Go to Track 3 for directions.